Lies have been around as long as humans have been communicating. We've been lying to each other. Where this becomes a problem is when it harms people, when it harms public institutions, and when it undermines our capacity to trust one another, which is really fundamental for any kind of public structures or any kind of effort to achieve good things together.
Welcome to Multilateralism Unpacked, the podcast of the United Nations University Center for Policy Research. My name is David Pastorelli. I'm the director of the center. I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Simon Chesterman, David Marshall Professor and Vice Provost at the National University of Singapore. Simon Chesterman was previously Dean of NUS Law from 2012 to 2022, and his research and teaching focus is on international law, global governance, and the regulation of emerging technologies, particularly artificial intelligence. Simon, we've invited you to this conversation because you're about to publish a new Oxford handbook on misinformation and disinformation, an important topic. We've just come from a public conversation on your work. I wanted to know what got you interested in the topic and why pick this topic for your next piece of research.
So I think all of us are aware how much our access to information has transformed in the course of our lives with the emergence of the internet. We now have at our fingertips information from around the world. The problem is that information abundance has not led to trust and often hasn't led to wisdom because we have no quality control. It's as easy to share a lie as it is to share the truth. And one unfortunate reality is that often the lies are a lot more attractive and more likely to be shared on social media and so on. So all of this led me and a bunch of researchers at the National University of Singapore to say, well, how can we address this? And what we realized is you can't address this from one dimension alone. So I'm looking at the regulatory and policy things we can do, and I think that's part of the answer. But we've also got computer scientists and technologists working on the ways in which fake information can be produced, disseminated, detected, and so on. But then there's a third group looking at the behavioral economics of this, what happens in human psychology that means that many of us are not only susceptible to misinformation and disinformation, but often attracted by it, more likely to be energized by it, excited either positively or negatively. And so for all these reasons, we thought it was a fascinating project to spend some years on, and we're delighted to soon be releasing the Oxford Handbook of Misinformation and Disinformation to share some of that research and hopefully some of the ways in which we can address the problem without creating new ones.
Simon, when I think about misinformation and disinformation, there are two terms that I think many people tend to understand. But I've heard other terms used as well. I've heard the umbrella term information pollution that covers many different ideas. And the UN has recently written a lot about information integrity. Could you just orient us? What do these terms mean and what is the difference and the distinction between the different terms that we're using?
Yeah, so they're looking at the same problem through slightly different lenses. So I think information integrity is a great way of framing the fact that we want an information ecosystem that is reliable, trustworthy, has some measure of authenticity, and so on. In the project that we've been looking at, we're looking primarily at the kind of harmful stuff. And there's a tendency there to think that the problem is falsity, that false information is bad. But we would distinguish between false information that is innocently shared and false information that is malevolently shared with an ill intent. So the first category of false information shared benevolently we would call misinformation, things like urban myths, rumors, and so on. And then there's the disinformation that is shared with ill intent, the kind of hostile information campaigns, the propaganda that is intended to manipulate a population. There is a third category that we address, what we call malinformation, which is notionally true information that is shared with ill intent. So that's things like revenge pornography or doxing, trying to embarrass someone, trying to harm someone with truth. And so in all of this space, though, the challenge really is to work out what is the problem we're trying to solve. And it's not the existence of lies. Lies have been around as long as humans have been communicating. We've been lying to each other. Where this becomes a problem is when it harms people, when it harms public institutions, and when it undermines our capacity to trust one another, which is really fundamental for any kind of public structures or any kind of effort to achieve good things together.
It's interesting. You mentioned how attractive this information can be and pulls people in. I'm wondering, you know, thinking on the indices that have emerged over the last few years on global risks, misinformation and disinformation is climbing in the ranking. I think in a 2026 ranking, it was listed in the short term, in the next 2 years, as the second biggest risk to polarization, to kind of international relations. And I wonder if that understanding, that appreciation of the severity of the risk, also maps onto the individual. Do we at a local level appreciate how dangerous this is?
So I think for many people, it's part of the background noise of daily life. I think if asked, most people are aware of it, but are they conscious of it as a risk day to day? Not necessarily, but this has changed over the last decade or so. So 10 years ago with the Cambridge Analytica scandal, I think there was a realization that information technology, the way in which we consume information, couldn't just lead to things like a weird recommendation of what you might purchase on Amazon, but could potentially affect elections in the most powerful country on the planet, in the United States. During the pandemic, we were both really consuming huge amounts of information, many of us under lockdown, but also aware of the lies that were spreading. The misinformation and the real consequences of those lies. And then more recently, with the emergence of generative AI, things like ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini, and so on, we realize how easy it is not just to produce ever greater quality information that looks real, but to do so at scale. And so I think that's really transformed the ways in which we engage with information. And then the challenge is, well, how do you make people appropriately skeptical of things that might mislead them, without making them so cynical that they don't believe anything?
In terms of the government regulation, I mean, governments are called upon to address this challenge. We've seen an uptick in government regulation trying to address this. Is that an effective approach, and can that misfire? Can we put too much faith in governments intervening to address this particular challenge?
Yeah, so one of the first bits of research that I did was to look at a mapping of government responses around the world. And we started looking at legislation around 1996, which is when the internet was really going mainstream. The US had the federal communications legislation, the Communications Decency Act. And then we tracked that onwards. And so initially, very few countries did anything. And that's partly because they had existing laws in place, obscenity, harassment, defamation, Official Secrets Act, and so on, but partly also because they didn't know what to do. And they were wary about unnecessarily constraining this technology. And so what happened over the subsequent decade or so is you did have the emergence of some countries really trying to rein in misinformation, disinformation, but they tended to be what some would call less free countries. And this is one of the dilemmas for governments. Do you regulate in order just to protect your civilian population, or are you trying to protect yourself? And that's really at the heart of one of the regulatory dilemmas in tackling the topic of misinformation, disinformation, is how do you avoid the perils of unfettered free speech that enables people to say outrageous, damaging, harmful things, but avoid the alternative, which is unnecessarily government censorship that will constrain people in what they can say and potentially what they can think.
And of course, the government isn't the only actor here. We frequently speak about platforms who provide the tools and the mechanisms to spread this information. And how do we think about their responsibility?
Exactly. And that's really where the heart of the problem lies, because any effort to address misinformation, disinformation is almost always going to come too late. It's sometimes said in this area that by the time the truth is put on its shoes, a lie has traveled around the world. And the technology companies, the platforms, are really where this starts. And the problem is that in the early days of the information revolution, in particular the early days of the internet, there was a question: how do we treat these platforms? How do we treat these companies that are the ways in which we access the internet? And basically, there were two models. Are they like telephone companies, or are they like newspapers? So a telephone company has no control over what you say speaking down the line. And so it would be crazy if you could sue a telephone company or regulate a telephone company for what was said online through their devices. But a newspaper makes decisions about what to publish. And so if a newspaper publishes a defamatory article, a libelous article, you can go after the person that wrote the article, but also the publisher of the newspaper. And in the early days of the internet, the US in particular was very clear: we're going to treat them like telephone companies. And in early days, that probably did make sense. The companies had no control about what people were posting on bulletin boards and so on. Jump forward to 2026 when we're talking, and it's now widely recognized that these platforms have algorithms that don't just blindly transmit content the way a telephone line does. They are exercising a kind of at least algorithmic editorial control. And we know that that's optimized for engagement. It's optimized for things that will push your buttons, excite you in a positive or negative way. And so just recently, there was a lawsuit against Meta, the first one really to be successful, accusing Meta not of disseminating harmful content, but of having a platform that was designed to be addictive. And so that suggests some ways in which it might be possible to hold these platforms, these technology companies, to account, because really without them, there is no solution to the problem of mis and disinformation.
You speak of addiction, and it makes me think of your writing on cognition and our motivations to seek out information, to spend time understanding information, to help change our minds. And it strikes me that that is a major part of this, is our motivation and the incentives that we have to go out and seek information that we think is authentic. What can you say about the nexus of the cognition and the attractiveness of misinformation and disinformation?
Yeah, so the behavioral economists that we've been working with have studied this, and there's now a lot of evidence that basically people like exciting falsities more than they like boring truths. And that really speaks to the ways in which some people, many people perhaps, use social media in particular. They're not using social media the way you might read a very serious, sometimes boring newspaper just to get information. They're blurring the lines between that source of information and entertainment. And the problem is now with the decline of traditional media, that's how a lot of people are getting their information. So young people are getting their quote-unquote news through TikTok and so on. And so there's a very different mind space. If you're turning something for entertainment, that's not exercising your critical faculties the way you might be when you're doing something, a serious course of study, or even when you're looking at a serious newspaper. So I think in that sense, our lines have been blurred. But there's also the problem of information overload. There is so much information out there these days that I don't think anyone realistically expects to be able to absorb all the news. And so we passively consume things, and that means that we are less and less likely to be exercising our critical faculties. So the reality is, yeah, many people are traveling through the world, getting bombarded by information, and it's actually quite a rational response not to spend huge amounts of time critiquing everything, because then you'd have no energy. And so, yeah, the end result is that we are offloading a lot of our critical faculties in order to merely accept the information that's being served up, and then perhaps not realizing that the reason it's being served up to us is not so that we're well-informed, rational, good-thinking citizens, but it's being served up to us so that we can consume ever more advertisements.
It strikes me then that authenticity is actually quite valuable in this moment, and where we find authentic information, how we think about authentic sources and authentic information. And this brings me to the United Nations. The United Nations has been addressing this particular challenge, and they've done it in multiple ways. They've produced principles, but they've also produced or they've also endeavored to address very specific types of misinformation and disinformation. So, for example, they've called out the role of advertising by the oil industry, the fossil fuel industry, which is driving a sense of climate skepticism. And so when we think about the authenticity of knowledge, the role of the UN, what scope is there for the UN to act in this space, to help address these challenges?
Yeah, so you've really highlighted an important issue, which is authenticity or just trust. Who can we trust? Where is a trusted source of information? And so this is true at the macro level and the micro level. The micro level, not that climate is a micro issue, but in specific areas, you're absolutely right that there are concerted efforts to change a narrative. And there's a clear echo here with what happened with tobacco companies that had the information that theirs was a product that was causing irreparable harm, and yet their economic incentive was to delay at least for years in many cases, the legal consequences of that action. And we're seeing that now with the climate change and the effort on the part of oil companies, which know that they're in a declining industry, to at least preserve their benefits. So that's at the kind of micro level of issue specific. But also at the larger macro level, we really have a trust deficit in the world. And that's partly because of not just the quality of misinformation, disinformation that's going out there, but also the quantity. There is so much information out there that there is this idea of the liar's dividend, that it's not just that harmful falsities will be propagated and will cause harm, but that the prevalence of the amount of false information means that even true scandalous things will go under the radar because they can be buried. So what's the role for the UN? Well, the UN, at least in many parts of the world, is a trusted institution. If the UN says something, people may be more likely to believe it than when their government says it. In some situations, more than when a technology company says it. And so there's at least a window of opportunity there, maybe, for the UN to play a role in addressing this authenticity deficit in a way that would minimize the harms associated with some of the misinformation, disinformation problems without necessarily introducing new ones, which occasionally comes up when governments overact in order not just to suppress lies that are harmful to the population, but even truths that are inconvenient to themselves.
Do you think we're miscalibrating our hope that the UN can act? Do you think that we have our expectations are not in line with the machinery of the UN? Or do you think that there's still a way of using that machinery to positive effect?
Yeah, so the UN has always had crises of expectations, or a mismatch between expectations and reality. In this space, yeah, I mean, the UN is certainly not going to be the solution, but it can be part of the solution. I think one of the challenges is, yeah, picking your battles. So where the UN can really make a difference, in conflict zones where it's not just lies about public institutions, it's lies about specific people that can lead to real harm. In those situations, I think there is an awareness that the UN has a role to play. So more than 30 years ago, I interned at, well, less than 30 years ago, but more than 30 years ago, we had the war crimes that took place in Rwanda, the genocide in Rwanda, which started and was exacerbated by Radio Mille Collines spreading heinous lies about the Tutsi population. So I think in conflict zones is one area where the UN could make a difference. In developing countries, in developing development programs, the UN can also play a role in sharing good information. Pandemic preparedness. We saw during the pandemic what the World Health Organization called an infodemic, and a real desire for trusted, reliable information. But there is a risk also that the UN bites off more than it can chew. And even the World Health Organization, I think, was accused at times of overreach. So I think the UN can play a coordinating role, but I would see it more as a kind of architect than a solution in addressing this problem. Because what you need is you need a multi-level approach. So absolutely, the most important thing on a day-to-day basis is up to individuals. What are they going to believe? How are they educated? How do they think about their information diet? Should they think of it more like their nutritional diet, where you know you shouldn't eat ice cream all day, and maybe you should also know that you shouldn't watch TikTok all day as your source of information? We need the technology companies to do the right thing, not out of the goodness of their hearts, but because they're incentivized to do the right thing, that they are, if necessary, compelled to do the right thing. We need states to regulate responsibly, because without them, they're the only ones with the regulatory hammer. But in all of this proliferation, I think the UN can at least play a coordinating role of developing shared standards, shared expectations, and hopefully shared measures of whether what we're doing is having an impact.
Thank you. You've gone global and you've talked about all the different levels and layers where we could potentially have an intervention. And I want to come to the lowest level, the individual. Sometimes we think about the individual as being informed and therefore having been given the information that they need to act. Do you think that there's too much onus placed also on individuals?
Yeah, so this has been a problem for many years. And I think it was Yuval Noah Harari who said this first, that there's an assumption that more information will make us wiser. But actually, information is a bit like food, to stick with my nutrition analogy. And there's a point beyond which more food is not actually good for you. It can be harmful for you. And I think we're seeing that in the information space. There is so much information. The problem is not access to information. The problem is quality control of information and also impulse control of where our impulses take us. So, yeah, I think on a starting basis, it's great if people can be informed, can be thoughtful about their information diet. But I think just relying on them to make good decisions is not going to be realistic. We need to educate them. We need to incentivize them. But we also need to protect them from harmful information. Again, sticking with the food analogy, there are food standards. There are poisons that are prohibited. There are things like alcohol and tobacco you've got to be a certain age to consume. And I really think some of that needs to come into our information diet also, perhaps starting most obviously with protecting kids. So it's astonishing that children have access to all the world's information, but can't go out and buy a cigarette or a bottle of beer. I'm fully in support of that, but maybe we should be more thoughtful about the information they're consuming as well.
Simon, one of the remarkable things of an edited volume is that you get to work with a large group of researchers and they all bring something to the table. Can you tell me something that surprised you or that you found that was interesting in working with this group of researchers on this new edited volume?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the joys of being an academic is you get to think about things just because they're interesting and you're surrounded by interesting people. But this interdisciplinary project really did move me out of my comfort zone. So I've got a lot of experience dealing with law and regulation, but it was fascinating learning about the behavioral science, the psychology of the reasons why in which people consume and share information. But the most illuminating thing to me was really engaging with the computer scientists. And then we had an aha moment at one point where we were talking about the problem. And then I realized we had completely different methodological approaches in that they thought this problem could be solved the way you can debug a computer system. And my social scientist colleagues and I were bemused and then realized that this was actually a really important distinction, that for us, you couldn't solve the problem of misinformation, disinformation. The best you could hope was to manage it. And I think we learned a lot from each other, and we're still learning and looking forward to working with them on possible next steps to see whether we can operationalize these things and maybe bring some of them into the policy space as well.
I tend to find with these conversations where we're dealing with a global challenge that there can be a silver lining, there can be a message of hope. And if there was a development or something that put us on a trajectory that was more hopeful, what would you think that is?
So, I mean, I think the possibility of change at an individual level is one thing, and clearly humans are immensely capable of growth. My hope is that what people will realize when they get over the ability to generate fake images, it may be a bit like chess. So chess, back in 1997, when Garry Kasparov lost to Deep Blue, many people thought, well, that's the end of chess. But actually, chess is now more popular than ever, and we're using computers to work out new ways of playing, new strategies. We saw the same thing with Go after 2016. So there's a possibility that we will get through this experience of seeing how easy it is, how trivially easy it is to produce compelling fake information, and then realize that maybe the important thing isn't the volume of information or even the quality of the fake, but the ability to trust something. And that will inspire us to invest in things like education, invest in journalism, and invest in a little bit of authenticity in order to preserve some measure of shared reality that will make it possible for us to do all the things that we would like to do as communities, whether that's achieving the Sustainable Development Goals or just having a good, safe and prosperous life.
Simon, this has been a fascinating conversation. We have seen so much interest in this topic, and we are just months away from the UN's first global dialogue on AI, and certainly this issue of misinformation, disinformation will feature centrally to that dialogue, given how closely it ties to algorithms and AI. I want to congratulate you on this work with your co-authors. Thank you so much for sharing the insights with us today, and good luck on the publication.
Thanks so much, David.